Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 18th, 2005. Tonight's forum, Whatever Happened to Leviathan? Science, Faith, and the Bible. Disc number FO-2005-28.
Forum tonight, it's 8:30. We go an hour, but if it's getting really lively, we can keep going till people stop talking, I think, tonight. The topic tonight is whatever happened to Leviathan. You'll hear more about Leviathan. But mostly to talk about the Bible and faith and science. I'm Nancy Winder, and I'm on teaching staff as the Village Philosopher this week. And everybody else can introduce Yvonne. Levon, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Yvonne Batalden, and I'm on teaching staff this week doing the Science and the Bible series. And I'm normally a teacher at Colby-Sawyer College in New Hampshire.
I'm Paul Batalden, and I'm here as Levon's teaching assistant this week. I'm not doing that. I teach at Dartmouth Medical School, where I teach about the improvement of quality and safety of healthcare.
This is Bob Ekblad, or Elijah, depending on how you know. And Bob plans to be part of the forum, but he and his brother hiked up to Copper Basin, and they left about 5 o'clock.
He is in the village.
He's in the village?
Yes, he's in the building.
He's in the building. Yes. All right. Okay, so we're getting there. So Bob will be there, and he's been our Bible study leader this whole week, so we can get in on that.
Here he comes.
Okay. Yay!
Wow. You are impressive.
Did you go, you made it to Copper Basin and back? All right. This is your seat right here. We can get going. We won't watch Bob change the clothes. The topic comes out, as you all know, there's a lot of conversation about this topic in our country, especially. In magazines, NBC The Time magazine just last week that was on intelligent design, and a lot of conversations. So we felt it would be, especially since it really fit with what the teaching staff is doing this week, not only with Levon and Bob, but also what Will Shore has been doing with about city planning, you know, and how do we look at that stuff, and all the kinds of concerns that come with all the things we know over against all the things we believe. So we're going to, at least, you can. We'll do it first, and then you can do it last, so you can see what we're doing. How's that? I'm going to start by just telling you a couple stories. I'm a parish pastor in Seattle, Washington. That's what I do for a living. And I'm going to tell you a couple stories about how this issue has intersected with my own life. One is actually out of my own family. I have a cousin whose husband is a meteorologist, and he's taught at universities in the Western United States for his whole career. He's now retired. And in two cities where he lived teaching, he went to his Lutheran pastor, both places, and said, I'd really like to have a conversation about how science engages the creation stories. And in both instances, his pastor said, we don't go there. As a result, well, I mean, he's not a Lutheran anymore. I don't know whether that's doing it, but also, and so, but he did then sort of, he does a lot of work sort of showing how the church deals with the Bible regarding science isn't correct, and he's really interested in the scientific observation of UFOs, including the kind, there's a whole school of thought about how Jesus actually came in a UFO. That's a whole, it's kind of a weird thing too, but I often wonder what would be different if his pastors had been willing to engage him on the topic, and if they had the ability to do so. So I think generally when a pastor says we don't go there, they don't know how to go there. The other story is one of just a few years ago, a family in my congregation, a couple came to me, and they said they were going to leave the congregation. They wanted to go to something that wasn't an ELCA Lutheran, and they had a list of things that would be on a lot of list of people who felt that maybe the ELCA was too liberal for them or something like that. But one thing they said really caught my attention, and that was that they had just been in a small group event at the church, and they were conversing with other people there, and So the husband in this couple said to me, he said, well, yeah, and when we went to that event last week, I was talking to Harry. And he said, well, you know about Harry. And I knew from who they were and stuff, I knew exactly where he was going with that. And I didn't debate him at that moment because I needed to be the pastor and not a debater. But if the conversation I wanted to have with him in my dreams is the reason he said, well, you know about Harry. Who Harry is a clone researcher. He does research on cloning. He was just finishing his PhD. And that would be a big problem for this guy because it's against the Bible, it's against God, it's against the creation. And what I would like to have said to him was, you know, I hope that nobody in your family ever gets a blood cancer. But if they do, the good news is they're very treatable. And what will happen is the oncologist will come to you and say, okay, we're going to treat your daughter's leukemia, and here's the five poisons we're going to use to do it. And this is going to go. So I'm going to say, if that were to happen, would you say to that doctor, I would like to know the research pathways for the poisons you're going to give, the chemotherapy you're going to give my daughter for her leukemia? And if any of those chemotherapy concoctions came out of either stem cell research, fetal tissue research, or cloning research, would you refuse the treatment for your daughter? And for me, in my mind, that story talks about the tension that we have in trying to understand who we are as people of faith and people of the book, and also then people who live in a world that is scientific and that we benefit from in every possible way. So that's my start.
25 years ago, Paul and I came with Ivor and Jenny and our children to Holden. And George Anderson was doing a series on creation stories in the Bible. And he introduced me to the Leviathan story that I had completely never heard of. And it's is it five or six places in the Bible where Leviathan is referred to? And sometimes Leviathan is just described as a crocodile or a large whale or some kind of sea monster. But if you follow the certainly the Canaanite creation stories and probably Babylonian creation stories, Leviathan is chaos, the monster of chaos in the ocean, and God creates order out of chaos. And so, but we don't ever hear the story of the creation of order out of the chaos of Leviathan anymore. But instead, we've kind of discarded that story, and we don't feel like we need to believe that God created the earth out of the chaos of the sea monster. But we feel that we have to take the story of Genesis 1 quite literally, when in fact, maybe we need to look for the truth that might be gleaned from those stories, both the Leviathan story and Genesis 1, to help us in looking at the world today. I don't really want to give up any of the stories. I think there's truth there in all of them.
So I was trying to figure out who this Leviathan really might be in today's world. I mean, if the story is a story that goes back to the ancient Middle East, and it was a story of a good God that overcame a monster that was preventing the creation of a good world, who or what might be a monster like that today, preventing the continuing creation of a good world? And I found myself thinking about, oh, how many thousands of items might be on such a list, but I found myself coming to the question about, well, I wonder if that monster today that's preventing the creation of a good world is our own unwillingness to pursue the development of understandings in a world that's both uncertain and ambiguous. Maybe the monster is our love affair with sound bites. And simple labels that really don't help us build understanding of the creation that's trying to come. So I was kind of curious about who Leviathan might be today, what that monster might be, and how we might be connected to it as Job was.
Well, my perspective kind of comes from a totally different place, which is reading the Bible with inmates, you know, reading the Genesis story with inmates. And I've had some, a lot of people just assume that they have to embrace a literal seven-day creation. Otherwise, God is going to punish them by not helping them get out of their core problem that they have. So there's kind of an assumption that's what I'm going to insist that they embrace, right, when they come into my Bible study for the first time. Because the word on the streets is that, you know, if you want to go to heaven, you've got to believe in a seven-day literal creation, and otherwise you're falling down the slippery slope of, you know, towards atheism if you entertain ideas about evolution and don't take the Bible literally and all this stuff, right? So, I mean, I've gotten letters from inmates. I've gotten collect calls from people in solitary confinement in Walla Walla, okay, which is the state prison here, where people will say, look, you know, I'm kind of coming to faith, but I got a major struggle. And I'll say, well, what's going on? They say, well, people are mocking me. They're mocking me because I'm really excited about what I'm reading. I'm reading the Psalms and all this other stuff, and people have been telling me, you know, where does Cain get his wife from? You know, questions like that, right? And I look at Genesis chapter 2 and I think, Genesis chapter 4, where did Cain get his wife? You know, how could Cain have gotten his wife if Adam and Eve were the first humans created, right? And then Cain was like the first offspring and then suddenly he gets married, right? Where does he get his wife from? So, I mean, you know, reading the Bible as a historical kind of chronological account gets us into all kinds of trouble. And in contrast, I found other ways to read Genesis, and it's one of the places where I go first almost, since, you know, it makes sense to open the Bible at the beginning. You know, inmates don't understand why you, who've never opened the Bible in their life, don't understand why you should begin the Bible, you know, somewhere in like Romans or something, like most Lutherans do or whatever, right? They just assume you got to begin with Genesis 1. Well, how many of you read Genesis chapter 1 for your devotions? If you're looking to, you know, for kind of be inspired in your faith, probably not many, right? But I just want to give you one quick read of Genesis 1:1-3, just to show you how I think it is. It's more productively read. There's an error in our translations of our Bibles when it says in the beginning God created. The better translation is in the beginning when God, you know, was creating. Okay, that's a more literal read of the Hebrew. And the modern translations, the most modern translations that you'll see out there in commentaries will have something like that. Okay, when you say in the beginning God created, that assumes that this is talking about a historical beginning. I mean, that translation comes out of that particular bias too, right? So if you think, okay, in the beginning of God's creating of the heavens and the earth, the earth was formless and void, and the darkness covered the face of the deep. I'll ask the inmates, I'll say, well, are you guys, what was it like in the beginning when God was creating? And they'll say, the earth was formless, void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. So then I'll say something like, well, when you guys look at the world from your perspective, does it seem like it's, do you see any of that now? Anything that's like formlessness or kind of darkness? Or is everything mostly really positive and light? Okay, and they'll say, oh, you know, dark and chaotic, for sure. You know, well, where do you see the darkness? Oh, they'll say drugs and, you know, and gangs and, you know, and just all the stuff that we're into, right? I mean, all these fines that the courts have laid on us and our women, you know, that are out cheating on us while we're all reading the Bible in the jail. And, you know, they say all kinds of stuff. They point to all kinds of darkness and chaos, right? And then you say, well, what does this tell us about what it was like when it was really dark and chaotic in the beginning. And then they say, well, it says that God was creating. Okay, well, is God creating anything in the middle of the darkness of your lives? Do you guys sense that God's creating anything in the middle of the darkness of your lives? And they'll say, well, yeah, actually, you know, people that have been to the Bible studies for a couple weeks or months will say things. They'll give testimony to things that God is doing in their lives, answering prayers and different things, right? And then we'll say, well, okay, well, that's great. Well, look what else it says. And then someone will also ask someone to read the next part. It says that the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. Okay, so according to this text, the Spirit of God is present over the chaos, over the darkness, over the disasters of our lives, right? So do you guys ever notice that? And anyway, I get people kind of reading that way, right? And then you know, God said, let there be light. And it's just incredibly very hopeful story when you read it as a salvation story rather than as a creation story. And some people, like, I've done that read with seminarians, and they'll say, oh, well, that doesn't work, because how could the darkness be, you know, be badness? Because evil hasn't come into the world until chapter 3. You know? So darkness, you can't equate that with drugs and chaos and the war in Iraq or anything like that, because this is talking about good darkness. Okay, and I say, okay, well, what about if we go to John chapter 1? John chapter 1 is talking, is a midrashic read of Genesis chapter 1. And look what it says. I mean, if you read through the Gospel of John, darkness is seen as a metaphor for evil and brokenness in the world, right? So John, who is a lot closer to the scriptures than we are, in terms of time period, you know, he was 2,000 years back, closer to the scriptures, to the Hebrew text than we are. John and 1 John even more are reading darkness as, you know, as chaos and social darkness and, you know, evil and things like that, right? So here's an example from 1 John, which is also kind of based on Genesis chapter 1. Well, here's just an example of the use of darkness. If we say that we have fellowship with him while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not do what is true. But if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Christ, his son, cleanses us from sin. Okay, so just that sense of how is darkness being used, and how is light and darkness being used in that verse? Is it talking about like this light of the sun and the lights behind here that are illuminating our room? Is it talking about the darkness of the outside? How is light and darkness being used by 1 John? You know, metaphorically, right? For goodness and for evil, for the presence of God, the absence of God. So I mean, that's an example of one example of how Genesis can be used positively, you know, for good news, you know, in contrast to just seeing it as a proof text for a literal 7-day creation, which I think is not the intention of Genesis chapter 1. I mean, if anything, it's a liturgy, it's a liturgical text, marking the 7 days, right? Day 1 is, you know, the first is Sunday, right? That's the day when we say, let there be light, and that's resurrection day. You know, day 7 is the day when God ceases. You know, when Jesus ceases to exist, he's dead on the cross, right? And luckily, day 7 isn't the end. Day 1, 8th day, you know, 7 continues, and so we have a break in the cycle, you know, where life is introduced. I mean, reading it in these ways is what it's about, I think. And this other creationist approach just strips, it robs the scriptures from us, you know, as a place of good news, I think.
So, we've got... Yeah, go ahead. Now, all of you get in on this,
so
let's talk
to
Larry.
One, in terms of the very beginning of Genesis, Bereshit, without the pointing, you really don't know whether there's a the there or not. So yeah. You really don't know whether it's in the beginning or simply in beginning. Yeah. And I think there's a big difference between in the beginning and just in the process of beginning. Doing what, you know?
Yeah.
And then the other I wanted to pick up on your illustration with Was it your brother or brother-in-law?
It's a cousin's husband.
Okay, yeah. The meteorologist. I think that's exactly what happened with Darwin. Somebody was mentioning that the other day in their session. That Darwin, in his first book, uses God and faith language. And then there's this storm of criticism from the church. Oh, this is godless stuff, Darwin. And then I think Darwin is basically turned off by all of this criticism and where it's coming from, the church, and just says, okay, to heck with you. And then he can go on his own direction and kind of leave that behind. But I think he's forced to leave that behind by the church.
So what all the rest of you think about all this? The problem where you live?
One of the problems that I encounter, I'm a little bit aligned with you, I'm at USC in the Department of Preventive Medicine, and I'm also very active in our church in the Pasadena area, and our son goes to a Christian school that is very evangelical. They're non-denominational, but the two predominant churches are not aligned with any particular denomination, and they tend to have a very literal interpretation of Scripture. And a lot of it is just, well, we have a square box and everything absolutely must fit into that square box. And they're really not interested in anything that challenges that box. So when they talk about, and they teach it in the part of the curriculum, they talk about a literal 7-day creation. And, you know, bless those junior high school kids, somebody will come up and say, explain fossils. And it's never satisfactorily explained. And some of it that I see is their teachers are just not prepared to say anything more than the box. And there isn't a teacher that can go back and discuss Darwin, that can go back and intelligently discuss discovery of fossil records and what does it mean and what doesn't it mean. Where I get bothered by I don't know how else to describe it other than censorship in our school systems, where some people say, you know, you must not teach this part of science. You can teach this part of science, but you must not teach this part of science. Is where have we as a society become so afraid of intellect? I was taught that we were given gifts, and one of the gifts that we have is curiosity. And where have we stopped being curious?
Is that the choice of the schools that your children are attending? That's not true of all schools.
It's not true of all schools, no. In this particular school, it just happens to have a more fundamentalist, I guess, leaning to it. And we try and balance it at home with, well, you can look at it this way, but you can also look at it this way. But I suspect that most kids don't get that dual conversation. They get either one or the other. And if it doesn't ring true to kids, they're not going to buy it.
Okay, over here?
Yeah. I want to throw a distinction out that I found useful. That's, it isn't so much the literalism as it is the understanding of the Bible as a book about the material world. That it's a question of materialism. That somehow our scientific experience has to match what the Bible says. And in getting there, I think what has happened is the church has lost one of its historically important facets, and that's mystery. that we are unable to live with mystery anymore. You know, we've been, and we can throw this back at people who do this, this kind of pigeonhole exercise. That, who said you have to, you know, judge the Bible by scientific criteria, that we're going to have to know everything that the Bible lays out independently, like we have to go check up on it or something. The Bible is not a science book. And there's this huge disconnect there. And I, that sort of thinking is what leads us, you know, to that there's only one kind of knowledge. There's the knowledge of the Bible and science, and they must correspond somehow. But of course, as humans, we have very fractured intellects, and we think in lots of different ways.
You know, one of the big issues there is that people would say, well, then are you saying the Bible's not true? Okay, and see, this is where the big debate comes in, and people want to say,
well, this got to be. But people believe that the only truth is material truth.
Yeah, right.
You know, and if someone who professes to be a theologian tells me that, I say, well, you're a dyed-in-the-wool science, period.
With somebody over here, and then there, and then you are. Yeah, go ahead.
I think Genesis is true. I think it says our God did all of this.
Yeah.
And it gives us a story, a tangible way to explain it. But it's a mythology in a way of doing that. Yeah. What I don't understand is the disconnect with science. What we're learning from science is how wonderful our God is. We're learning how complex it is. We're learning how unbelievable it is. I mean, it's exactly the same message, it seems to me, as the message of Genesis.
And I think this, when you said, is creating, if we think of creation as this wonderful ongoing process that is God's creative action in the world, then we don't have to say, well, this is exactly what God did on these days, but it's an ongoing process, and everything we learn about from our scientific perspective or whatever is really a revelation of how God works. And it isn't that if we let God only be the mystery that we don't understand, then we make God pretty small. And if you learn something, it's you're afraid you're going to take away from God. But if God is the creator, then we're only learning more about how God is creating.
And evolution and chance are really marvelously intelligent design.
A couple of things that I've been thinking a lot about this evolution and creation and faith and science and all that stuff for a while, and a couple of things talking about like truth and is the Bible true and things like that, and one of the things I guess that maybe it's more philosophical in nature, but is there truth outside of fact? And I think sometimes what a lot of people that are looking at, growing up in a fundamentalist household, people, you believe the Bible was true because you believed it was fact. And they would not make that kind of disconnect almost, you know, not looking at the truth of metaphor and other things. And then another thing that I guess maybe more of a question than just to discuss this was, and you mentioned this intelligent design that I went to a fundamentalist Christian college that was very much played up in the sort of creation evolution debates that went on there. And I'm just kind of curious sort of what's to talk about some of intelligent design.
No, you go, then me.
From my faith perspective, intelligent design is really what I believe. I mean, I believe that God is in this creative process creating the world. But it's not from a scientific perspective. I mean, it's not science. Whether you're a philosopher or a scientist, all efforts to prove the existence of God have not worked. You can't prove the existence of God. And so I can see wonderful design in nature and these wonderful biochemical pathways that all fit together, and I think it's just amazing. But that doesn't prove that God did it, unless I believe God did it. So that in a science classroom, you can't teach intelligent design because it's not scientific method. But that doesn't mean that there isn't intelligent design, but I can't prove it scientifically.
So, I mean, because a lot of what I heard kind of in this particular college was that evolution and embracing that would sort of take away from intelligent design, I didn't necessarily buy that, but being an impressionable 20-something and growing up in this world, it was difficult. It didn't make sense here, and I didn't quite know how to connect it.
I think evolution and chance really are intelligent design. If you wanted to create a species, a living world that was capable of sustaining itself, you would take full advantage of those principles. It's the most incredibly intelligent design. You can't think of a more intelligent design than to use chance.
And it doesn't contradict the Bible.
No.
Because the Bible doesn't tell how, and intelligent design does, but that doesn't deny God did it.
Okay, go ahead. I've been waiting, then her and then you. Okay.
If you look
just a
at
second, I would you want to? Go ahead, Bob.
If you look at the beginning of Genesis, the first word, you know, the ancient rabbis believed that the first letter of the Hebrew Bible contained everything. Okay, and they wondered why it was Bet instead of not Aleph. Why was it the second letter of the alphabet? Right. And so the Jewish rabbis, they all have all kinds of speculation about how it's, you know, Bet is pointing towards the future, and just all kinds of wild kind of interpretation. But if you look at Colossians, the Christians do the very same thing. They believe that the first letter contains everything. And it's the bet, it's in, okay? And then they have, and the second letter, second part of the of Bereshit is in, and then Rosh is the head. Okay, but head can be translated from Hebrew as beginning, head, chief, all these different things. So check out what they do. This is a midrash on Genesis chapter 1, verse word 1, okay? And I wonder how this idea of the Christ being the one through whom everything is created, you know, how that would work in terms of fitting in with evolution or whatever, you know? But check this out. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn. That's a play on Rosh, this, you know, the Bereshit, of all creation. For in him, that's the Beit, okay, the first letter, in him, because in, you know, with Rosh, the in him. All things in heaven and earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him. Through him is the Beit, once again, and for him. He himself is before all things. The before is another Greek equivalent of Rosh, you know, the part of the first word of the Bible, the old of the Bible. He himself is before all things, and in him, once again, the Bay, first letter, all things hold together. He is the head, once again, a play on Rosh, because that's the Rosh means head. Okay, again, it's another Greek equivalent of the body, the church. He is the beginning. Okay, there it is. The firstborn, once again, Rosh. These are all synonyms, okay, Greek synonyms for the Greek translation, kind of equivalents of the first letter, or the first word of the Hebrew Bible. The firstborn of the dead, so that he might come to have first place, finally, you know, once again, in everything. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. Okay, so there's a Christo kind of exegesis of the first word of the Bible, which is another example of how truth. You know, there's truth in this story, right? But it's not scientific truth.
Ivor.
I think fear and uncertainty are a big part of it. Fear needs to have an inerrant word, and that wasn't enough, so it needs an inerrant world, which has no room for chance. All it's talking about. My first parish was in Central Texas, 45 miles north of Crawford, well-known city. That area, the entire area of Belcona Swale, runs all the way down to the Gulf, 300 miles and north that way, and it's almost solid shell rock, fossils. And in fact, in our cemetery there, we only went down about 4 feet because you had to pick through shells, fossils, to get a grave. and it's just too hard to go any deeper. And we have some of them in our yard that we brought as keepsakes or something.
Memory.
That place is full of fossils, and it's 300 miles inland and 500 miles above, 500 feet above sea level. down at the Mineral Wells, for years and years, there's been a resort, and there are dinosaur tracks there. They're in the riverbed. They're very clear, and there's a whole center there that talks about that, and that's been there for decades and decades, no problem. We visited there this last year with our grandson, wanted to show him the dinosaur tracks. Set up right outside of the state park is a huge tent that the intelligent design people have put up to tell you the true story before you go in there. And it's the aggression that has now is something new in this whole business. There's always been this inerrant Bible and stuff. The most beloved professor at PLU when we were there, 50s, and he had to account for this 6-day creation. So he said, well, God, you know, created it with a logical past. Why the devil would he go to that trouble to do that? But anyway, that's part of the history. I think it's the aggressiveness now of trying to get it into the school system, get it into the state parks, into the Grand Canyon, the whole shot, and to have it taught as though it were an alternative science. And some bogus scientists to back it up. And
it's not science.
I think it's very scary because of the school book thing and those kinds of aggressive attempts to change.
League champions over here.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting because I just spent the last year in the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, and we just brought up this debate 2 days ago. And I find it fascinating because in some ways we're talking about two polar opposites that are saying almost the exact same thing. I mean, on one hand, you have the fundamentalist Christians, or just many Christians in general, who look at the Bible and who say, this is literal, this is exactly how it happened. But there's also the other side, which is the evolutionist. And I think we also are forgetting how in schools, especially in the science world, students are being taught that evolution is exactly how everything happened, that this is the fact, this is the way, the truth, and the life. And I think it's kind of interesting because both sides are trying to argue the same thing, and they can't see how where the other one's coming from. And to me, it comes down to the idea of mystery versus, I mean, fact in some ways. And the fact that we can never quite find a way for the two of them to coexist. Because really, one side can't really be here without the other. And I don't know, I just find the debate really interesting because they're both trying to argue the same thing, just from a different perspective. They're almost both stubborn in their own ways.
Oh, okay.
And this guy in the green white flowered shirt had a comment too. Did you want to respond to her? just let Levon respond to her because she's a science teacher.
Okay. Part of it is not a very good understanding of how science works, because science is really not facts. And science is a collecting of information and interpreting it in the way that makes the most sense with the information you have right now. And a good scientist would never say evolution is fact, but that it's the theory that best fits all the data and information that we have. And no one says we shouldn't teach cell theory or, you know, any number of other theories.
Gravity.
Theory of gravity. Yeah. I mean, we really can't explain gravity very well either, but it explains how we observe the world pretty well. And nobody cares if we teach that, and nobody cares if we teach cell theory. Or theory of disease. Nobody cares about that either. But it's this understanding that somehow that theory is some wild idea that somebody comes up with, when theory is about as good as it gets in science. Yeah. But it's always up for grabs.
And I think, I mean, just to kind of, that's what's so interesting is how some people want to take the Bible and say this is the way that. There are many people who look at evolution in the same respect, mm-hmm. and say, this is it. Yeah. And evolution as a theory has tons of holes. I mean, it does, as far as being able to say that, yeah, it was just a complete progression.
Okay, green shirt with red and white flower.
Okay, thank you. It is a fascinating discussion. I think there's places in which both sides can be embraced, and I, in this whole beginnings and evolution thing, I like to go back, try to find, like on a scientific level, what's the start, maybe the real start, in terms of the Big Bang. And I guess I'd say I believe in intelligent design, and at the same time, I'm an evolutionist, and feel like I can say yes to a lot of what's being said here. And I think it's important to look at what has been discovered about the Big Bang scientifically, and sort of look at to see if maybe there's some sort of signature happening there. And the thing that's sort of unique or specific that we can know is the rate of expansion of the Big Bang. And through that, we've been able to find out that if just 1/1,000,000th of a percentage difference in the rate of expansion, there'd be nothing formed other than molecules. And likewise, the same small amount decrease in the rate of expansion, this whole thing wouldn't exist either. So it was like this very, 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 very incredibly fine-tuned rate that allowed all this to take place. So it's sort of like in that moment of explosion was planned us sitting there. Another thing that I find fascinating when I think about it is the creation of the chlorophyll atom or molecule. Through the formation of the chlorophyll molecule, we're here. And before that emerged, it never existed. And how planet Earth had such a thing emerge that was able to transfer sunlight into food energy, which made all this possible. We assume that, well, that's just sort of a normal thing. So I think that there's mystery upon mystery upon mystery in this whole creation thing. And I think that science can be a path to deeper faith. At least it has been for me.
Put this guy
over here. Oh, right. I don't know what if I can add too much more to this, other than to say I'm scared and I'm curious. I'm scared because I actually can't believe that we're having this debate in this country now, and that it is getting worse, you know, and that the whole climate around this topic is getting upset. I think we failed to really educate our young people or generations about what science is and what, how it works. And it saddens me, I guess. And then I'm curious to know how we got here and what streak in our character as a country allows us to be in this position.
I think that's why this is a monster to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually believe that this is a Leviathan of sorts, that there is a monster in this very movement that's going on in our country. And my belief is that we have gotten to that place because of a variety of different forces. In part, it's so much easier to get so much more information than we've ever had before. And the temptation is to want to put jam on that, rather than to deal with the uncertainty and the ambiguity that's there. And so sorting our way through that and building understandings in the midst of all that is the task of maturing this information age that we're in. And my sense is that we don't have an option about that. We can continue to pretend that we can sort of put some kind of preserve over it, but that ain't going to make it go away. So I think you're spot on. Spot on.
The July Harper's Magazine has in it the Harper's Index. Everybody seen the Harper's Index at some point?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
List all these percentages, and very interesting. And the July, and tried, somebody lifted it. So if anybody lifted the Harper's, the July Harper from the magazine room, give it to me. But I'll put it back there. But in the index it said, how the thing was, how many school districts, I suppose the implication of public school districts in the United States use the Bible as a major science textbook? 371. That's a lot. Yeah.
One of the things that concerns me in this, and to carry this theme a little further, you know, where does this kind of thinking come from? And I'm looking at it, it comes from a tradition that wants to know that God's hand is in everything, and it's to, let's say, to lift up and support humankind. It's very human-centric. That, you know.
Right.
The material world to us, the world that science is supposed to tame, is still looking pretty chaotic and fearsome. And we want to know that there's a hand here guiding things along. It's the old thing about, you know, you wanted to watch the old TV evangelists who profess to have this, you know, direct line to God because you want to, might as well go straight to the source, right? And that tradition is what wants to do the pigeonholing and wants answers for everything. And they just can't stand to leave all those loose ends out there.
Yeah, we're in love with our labels.
That's right.
Yeah. One thing,
yeah, Peter, just I wonder if
we're also in love with the history of our image. And that is part of the materialist Christianity need to have a God that knows everything and had a design. And so you have this conflict between a materialist Christianity and science, which is a form of materialism too. What I look forward to the day when we, and I don't think I'll live to see, when we look back at this controversy and say, those people were as foolish as those who argued for a flat earth. And, but what we are trying to teach children now by putting this nonsense forward is we're trying to teach them a tissue of lies. And to me that is the Leviathan, the chaos creeping in. We should not teach children.
I think you were saying something. Who is speaking? Somebody spoke up over here.
Upstairs.
Oh, upstairs. Okay, Peter. To Peter. Peter.
One thing that I find curious is to say, how does this affect your faith if what you believe you suddenly could find out a time machine was invented and you could be convinced that you were completely wrong, whatever side you're on this? How does that affect your faith? Is that what your faith is based on? And if so, I would hope that you would move to a higher level of faith to be able to say, this I can view this either way and my faith is still there. It may change somewhat how you look at things, but if that shatters your faith, then
you need to work on striking your faith.
But I don't think it needs to shatter your faith, because I think it works in conjunction. Science hasn't proven it yet. You mentioned that we used to think the world was flat. Well, when they found out the world wasn't flat, it didn't disturb our faith.
But what if it really is? What if we've been wrong, you know, we've made this mistake, and actually the world is flat? Do you lose your faith at that point? You suddenly go, uh-oh, we screwed this whole thing up, and let's close that whole village and turn it into a party.
They aren't that apart.
Larry, the young man right in front of you, and then you, okay.
I guess, in talking about, you know, like, what is the life, and what is, like, the streak in our character that does this, talking about, what is our response, though, to this kind of thinking in our culture as people of faith and as people, as thinking people? And I guess that, for me, is, it's so huge, I guess I can't get my mind around it. That's why I'm kind of like, let's talk about this. What is our response?
Go for it. Don't stop that question. Keep that question.
Yeah.
Don't
yeah.
ever let that question go and keep after it. You yeah. see, there really isn't a simple answer.
No, there isn't.
And you just have to keep asking that question and keep pursuing the assumptions that are underneath the answers. Because the devil is in the answers, not in the question.
Yeah. yeah. The French have an expression, for complexifier les choses, you know, you have to complexify everything, right?
Well, basically, you have to look for the assumptions
yeah.
underneath the answers, because the answers are beguilingly reassuring. They're not when you push into them. The yeah. question is what has to keep the issue alive.
Yeah. But so much of this, and I see this in my own family, just because of where I come from and stuff. So much of this thinking, you can't rationalize with a lot of people that are thinking like this, and the question, it just gets drowned out, and I don't know.
Well, giving them a hug doesn't take your question.
That's true.
Larry, and then over here.
I think one of the problems is that we tend to use words different, and it's a part of matter of language. For example, that word we just talked about and are talking so much about is theory, is we use the word theory in different ways. Science uses the word theory in one fashion. And I can talk about the fact that I've got a theory that the reason my wife burnt the steak tonight was she went out and did something. And we tend to use the word theory like that in general in society. And I think a lot of people think that understanding of theory is what science is talking about. And we're on different pages in terms of the way we use words. The word truth, for example, is exactly the same. The way we use the word mystery, the way we use the word myth, how we define those are different in different populations. And we need to get on, somehow talk to each other about the meaning behind the words we use.
My colleague, Dartmouth Jerry O'Connor, says that the tragedy of science is hypotheses killed by data.
Over here, and then you.
Yeah. I want to talk about the word of faith and what we can say. I just finished a book by Bill Bryson called Everything You Wanted to Know, and I can't remember the rest. But it was my first experience to really read a lot of science in the 30 years since college. And I came away from that with the overall impression, wow. How much we have learned in the last 30 years. I mean, it's just incredible. I took a lot of science in college, and I'm not a scientist now, but I couldn't believe it. And then my response of faith was, I feel like the fundamentalists, literalists are hijacking me because this is faith. The wow of what's being learned. We don't know anything yet compared to what we could know, but we're learning more, and it is just phenomenal. And the voices that are telling us some little glimpses of it here and there are not all voices of faith, but God is speaking through them too. And I think the voice of faith says that we should be wowed by all we're learning. It's an unbelievable God. And to cabin God off, to make God so small that he fits our literal need for, you know, 7 days is to do him or her a great disservice.
Very good.
Okay. And then, Bob, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main issues is people are just, there's so much fear
you know, fear of facing the bigness, you know, of all the discovery and fear of lack of control, losing control of that, right? People want to have control of that data, you know, the fundamentalist, that's the nature of fundamentalism, is to have control of the origins and to know the story and to be trusted, to be the authority that can give you, so that you know where to go to get the information so that you can keep yourself from going to hell. Because that's what it comes down to. Yeah. With fundamentalism, it's a fear of hell, it's a fear of, you know, having the wrong way of thinking and the wrong way of acting that would get God to send you to the wrong place, right? So it's all about fear and controlling the data that you need to have control over to avoid being on the bad, you know, God's blacklist.
Okay, green flowered shirt followed by league champions.
Well, Bob sort of answered the question I was going to ask, and that was just, you know, I'm a little confused as far as what we're identifying as being against. I think you hit upon that some, but I don't know if there's more. Is this a fundamentalist orientation to things, or is it more than that? I don't know.
Well, I see this monster thing as our tendency in the church and in society today to search for answers that are simpler and more concrete than they must be, because we selectively shut ourselves off from some of the other data that's available. And when we do that, and we do that in the newspapers, we do that in the televisions, we do that in the conversations, we do that in our political campaigns, we do that in the way that we try to make policy in today's society. This kind of simplification beyond the level at which things should be made simple. I mean, Einstein said you should seek to make things as simple as possible and no simpler. Yeah. And what we are engaged in is making things simple beyond where they in fact have reason to be simple. And we do that in the name of communicating with one another and making, quotes, intelligible what's going on. That's just the reverse of making things intelligible. What we're doing is we're putting a convenient label that stops our inquiry. And so we stop because we've labeled it. And so we lose the mystery that you're talking about. We lose the ability to really gain understanding. And if the church stamps a blessing on that, we kick all that inquiry out of the church. God forbid that leadership of the church. See, to me, that's the real hijacking of the church. And I think you put it on.
Well, it's also hijacking a concept of God it's so beyond anything we could ever articulate.
Right.
And if you want it to be what we could speak of, it's an awfully small God.
Right. That's the point you were making.
I'd like to do a parish pastor interject here, in that I think a lot of things, there's such our culture as it becomes increasingly diverse, which many view as a very healthy thing. And certainly the United States is built on welcoming diversity to a certain degree. You know, I mean, immigrants and the whole thing. We know how difficult that is, but it doesn't like it at the same time. So as our culture becomes more, people would like to know that there are more people like them, and I think they like that in church. People like to go to church, and they'd like to think that the person sitting next to them, you know, eats the same food, shops in the same stores, votes the same way, you know, thinks the same way about things like sex and children and stuff like that. And so more people look for that, and so they go to the places that will give them the box. And for most of us who are Lutheran, our theology allows for a lot more diversity and ambiguity, but it's still hard to. It's getting hard, increasingly more difficult to define that, to talk about the mystery. We gather here to hear the gospel every Sunday, and then we go out and do our own thing. You know, that's a very Lutheran thing to do. For my own congregation, we had a dear man in the congregation died 2 years ago, and among his pallbearers were the most politically conservative man in the congregation and the most liberal man in the congregation. And let me tell you, they are poles apart. They are on different planets. But they both carried his coffin. It's a Lutheran funeral, you know? And that's how it should be, not only politically, but how we think about all these things. We should be able to live together. But in our culture, it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that because of the fear inherent in that kind of diversity. So people pick up, they say, if this isn't true, I don't believe it. Ever heard that before? That was my echo of a 13-year-old in confirmation. Yeah, you were going to say something, League Champion.
I don't know, my comments changed, but...
You go, Sarah.
Thanks. I think my comments changed about 15 times.
Okay, yeah.
that's what I find so interesting is, growing up in the last 20-some years, like, we are in an age now where we are constantly wanting new information. We're constantly trying to seek more, learn more people, find new things about our world out. And yet at the same time, we're also this culture that's continually trying to narrow where we're at and narrow our view and put it into a smaller and smaller box. And sometimes both when I look at, hijacking religion, but also hijacking science. I mean, science was meant as a way of creativity, of wonder, of discovery, of mystery. And, kind of hijacking both sides and thinking, I feel like I'm almost like losing my humanness sometimes through the whole process.
One emeritus futurist once said that we've moved from a relatively well-developed industrial society into an information age that we've assumed has been equally well-developed. He said, much better to think of ourselves as moving from a well-developed industrial society to an immature information society. And one sign of that immaturity is the disconnect between the values and what we actually do every day. And there could be nothing that more accurately describes the problem we've got right now with this information society than I think to name it as an immature culture.
We are very much a polarized society with access to information versus those without, right. Not just access to information, but those without the education,
right.
To even begin to ask the questions,
right.
Of science.
Right.
For many people, just science is just this big wall, I don't understand it, therefore I'm going to dismiss it.
Yeah.
And I think that's some of the fear that's also part of this discussion.
I wonder too, just the role of, kind of what you're saying there, the role of access to information that we have and that it's so open for so many people to get it that aren't really, their mind isn't disciplined in a scientific kind of way for many reasons, but because there's certain terms or whatever, they assume they can make scientific sort of assumptions, and science is just a method. It's a method of understanding, but people are taking information and not looking at it in a scientific way, but yet calling it science.
Because it sounds like science.
Because it sounds like it, yeah. Because you use words like theory.
I wish we were taught how we were all naturally scientists and how we all engage in science every day.
Yeah,
exactly.
If we live in Western civilization, we're scientists.
Or just figuring out how things work when you're a kid.
Yeah. Or just watch a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old.
Right.
They're great empiricists.
Maybe that's something else you could say to the fundamentalists of the world, which is that science is a theory. And it's an attempt to explain data, as you said so nicely. And it's complicated and it's not complete.
Right, just like fundamentalism.
The fear is that science is claiming to be correct and right and absolute. And we don't hear that message of science being a theory which is constantly changing and evolving. That's and the there
key.
Are scientists.
That's the key.
Yeah.
And there
open
are
to criticism.
There are scientists that are very famous, like Richard Dawkins and a few that do not help that any because they portray that science has all the truth and that there's no other way of looking at the world than through the eyes of science. And that's no less generous than the fundamental view of religion. So we've got that problem from both sides. I mean, so.
It's not good science.
No.
One thing I think that we have to remember in all of this, and particularly in trying to understand this from a faith perspective, is it's not all about us. We're just part of creation.
Right,
And they, we want very badly for it to be all about us. And scientists make this mistake, and theologians make this mistake, and they're constantly being made. I remember there's an anecdote I have. Done a lot of sort of wilderness experiences with people in the church or the pastor, and we always were so amazed at how beautiful everything was, and he said, "Isn't God wonderful to put all this stuff here for us?" And one day we were having sandwiches up at Lyman Glacier, and we were talking about this, and suddenly we realized that we had been barking at the wrong tree all the time. God didn't put this stuff here for us. He put us here to go find it. And that's an entirely different perspective.
Right.
And we're just a little past 9:30, so you can keep talking. I want to close it with one. We have to bring it to a close, and please keep talking about this as you see one another, as you see all of us, to engage this conversation. I want to share one thing. There's a letter that's going around to clergy, but I would suggest that people could pick it up and just tell this guy they want to just put people of faith down in it. This guy, Michael Zimmerman from the University of Washington at Oshkosh, University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh. I just see UW is just, there is only one. But it's the, and he's trying to get, yes it is, it's very, very literal. And he's trying to get 10,000 signatures on this letter to go public with it. So, and this is the first paragraph. It's quite good. We've all looked at it. I don't know if you haven't seen it yet, but it says, within the community of Christian believers, there are areas of dispute and disagreement, including the proper way to interpret Holy Scripture. While virtually all Christians take the Bible seriously and hold it to be authoritative in matters of faith and practice, the overwhelming majority do not read the Bible literally as they would a science textbook. Many of the beloved stories found in the Bible, the creation, Adam and Eve, Noah and the Ark, convey timeless truths about God, human beings, and the proper relationship between creator and creation expressed in the only form capable of transmitting these truths from generation to generation. Religious truth is of a different order from scientific truth. Its purpose is not to convey scientific information, but to transform hearts. It's very good. And the rest of it says, these things work in complement. So there are copies of it here if you'd like to pick one up. And I'll leave this one here if anyone wants to pick one up. And you didn't get one, I'll make some more copies for you. Just say you need more copies and put it out. But thank you all very much for a very wonderful conversation tonight and for all your comments and questions.